from WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tom Friedman is pessimistic about Israeli-Palestinian relations. He thinks the most frightening thing we could do to Iran, short of an outright attack, is to get out of Iraq. And as for the Bush administration oil policy, he's tired of their patronizing attitude toward alternative energy sources. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Friedman about these issues and more. He writes a foreign affairs column for the New York Times. He's a three-time Pulitzer Prize winner, and his book about globalization, The World is Flat, has been on the bestseller list for about a year. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz pays tribute to Sarah Caldwell, the visionary founder of the Opera Company of Boston. She died last week at the age of 82. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After Hamas won the Palestinian legislative elections earlier this year, New York Times columnist Tom Friedman wrote, "Everything is now clear to me. What a mess." We're about to hear how Friedman's thinking has progressed with the latest news. Tuesday, Israelis gave a majority of votes to the new centrist Kedima Party. Yesterday, the new Palestinian prime minister and his cabinet were sworn in. We'll also see what Friedman has been thinking about Iraq, Iran, and the Bush administration. Friedman is a 3-time Pulitzer Prize winner. His latest book about globalization, The World is Flat, has been on the bestseller list for about a year. A new updated and expanded edition will be published in mid-April. Tom Friedman, welcome back to Fresh Air. What's your interpretation of the Israeli election this week?
Well, I think what you're seeing in Israel, Terry, is a trend that's been at work for a while, coming now to a head, and that is the Israeli center really asserting itself. The Kadima Party, which won the most seats in the next Israeli parliament, 28 seats, will be forming the government under its leader, Ehud Olmert, who has been acting prime minister ever since Ariel Sharon went into a coma, really represents that Israeli center that basically wants to get out of the West Bank as much as possible, and which supported Ariel Sharon's decision to unilaterally withdraw from Gaza. And it's an Israeli center that basically wants to disengage from the Palestinians as much as possible, and from, I would say, the Arab Muslim world as much as possible.
What do you think it will be like to proceed with a unilateral withdrawal from the West Bank and with the defining of Israel's boundaries with Hamas in power?
Much more difficult with Hamas in power, assuming Hamas does not change, doesn't embrace the basic principles of the peace process, which the Palestinian Authority has embraced in terms of recognizing Israel's right to exist and being willing to engage in a peaceful settlement. Then Israel, although it will unilaterally withdraw from the West Bank, with a Hamas government there, it will withdraw from far less.
I'm not sure I understand what the differences are in Israel between the left, the right, and the center now.
Well, in that, you're certainly not alone, Terry. I was in Israel a couple months ago. I went right after the Hamas election. And I really felt I had to see this firsthand because this was such a sharp and dramatic move. And after being there for a few days, I told everyone, I'm so glad I came. It's all clear to me now. What a mess. And the mess is on both sides, really. You're seeing the deck reshuffled in Israel, and you're seeing the deck reshuffled among Palestinians. Let me talk about each side for a second. I think, to me, the driving force in Israeli politics today, the thing that can explain more things, is the impact that 3.5 years of suicide bombing had on the Israeli psyche. I don't think, unless you've been to Israel during this period of the Second Intifada, began early 2000 and really lasted until just a few months ago. Unless you had been to Israel in this period and experienced the incredible fear and anxiety that Palestinian suicide bombing injected into Israeli society, the feeling that you couldn't go out your door, you couldn't send your kids to school, you couldn't go to the market or to the mall without worrying that a suicide bomb would explode in your midst. You cannot imagine the impact that has had on the psyche of Israelis. And the political impact of that deep scar has been the emergence of this Israeli center, which basically said, first to Ariel Sharon, and now in the last elections, we want to disengage from these people. We want to disengage from the Palestinians in Gaza. We want to disengage from them in the West Bank. And we want to build a wall 100 feet high. You can agree with it, disagree with it, say it's rational or irrational, but that to me, Terry, is the driving force on the Israeli side today. On the Palestinian side, what you're seeing are several factors at work. One is the incredible atomization of Palestinian society that was the product of Israeli retaliations for those suicide bombings. The targeted assassinations, which have removed certain leaders, the crushing of the Palestinian Authority for its complicity in those suicide bombings and its unwillingness really to confront the suicide bombers, and then, of course, the death of the Palestinian charismatic leader since the late 1960s, Yasser Arafat. So that's also created an incredible vacuum politically on the Palestinian side, which obviously has now been filled first and foremost by Hamas in the latest election.
What does the Israeli left stand for now?
What's really interesting about the Israeli left is that they are really left. If you looked at, for instance, the Meretz Party, which is I think, most important left-wing party today, headed by Yossi Beilin, their campaign slogan was, their campaign bumper sticker was, Beilin will divide Jerusalem. Now, you have to understand, Terry, 10 years ago, if someone had said, Beilin will divide Jerusalem, he might have taken them to court for libel 10 years ago. Today, it's his bumper sticker. In other words, what the left is basically saying is, not only do we want to disengage, we want to disengage all the way right back to the 67 lines. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about even redividing Jerusalem.
The Palestinian government is now led by Hamas, and many experts were really surprised by the outcome. But last year, when you were on our show, and when you were looking ahead to the Palestinian election, here's what you said, quote, Fatah is still perceived as a rather corrupt party, and its governing skills have been widely challenged and criticized. Hamas could do very well. I personally welcome that. I would have no problem if Hamas swept these elections, because I believe the only way to really transform groups like Hamas is by the burden of responsibility. Still feel that way?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a saying in journalism, which I've tried to live by, Terry, but have not always done so very successfully. And it goes like this. Never be smarter than the story. When the story is speaking to you, listen. And a lot of the stories I got wrong were because I was talking when I should have been listening. And right now, my advice, you know, to everyone is, let's just listen. The Palestinians, in a free and fair election that we, the United States, urged be held, have elected Hamas for a lot of very complicated reasons, some because of their reputation for not being corrupt, some for religious reasons, some because people are proud of the way they have been willing to engage in suicide bombing and the sacrifice they've made. It isn't a single explanation, but for whatever reason, Palestinians have elected Hamas. Now, I am a big believer in the Newtonian laws of gravity. And the fact is, Hamas is now responsible for the school system, the collecting of the garbage, the electricity. And anything that goes wrong in any of those areas is going to be Hamas's responsibility. And I believe that is going to be a very heavy burden, that the laws of Newtonian physics will apply to Hamas. I don't believe they're going to come out tomorrow and sing Hatikva in perfect Yiddish or Hebrew. But I do believe that the burden of that responsibility is going to inevitably have to moderate their behavior. How much? I don't know. How far it will go? No one can predict. But I can't tell you the speed or the length, but I think the direction is clear.
Okay, but one scenario goes like this. Because Hamas refuses to recognize Israel, and because the United States and the European Union insist that it does, or else it won't recognize the Hamas government, then the United States and the European Union are going to withhold financial aid to Hamas. So the scenario goes, if that happens, then Hamas, if something goes wrong with the schools or the local government or the potholes, whatever, they can just turn around and say, that darned United States isn't giving us money, and that's why we're in this predicament.
First of all, I understand the United States not wanting to extend foreign aid, U.S. tax dollars, to an organization that's an avowedly terrorist organization that's been proudly engaged in suicide bombing. So I don't expect the United States to do that. I don't expect Israel to give Hamas, sort of Lord knows, any foreign aid. But there is the issue of tax dollars. The fact is, Israel collects tax money. This is Palestinian money by and for Palestinians at the border, and every month transfers, it's about $60 million, that money to the Palestinian Authority. Israel has decided to withhold that transfer of what is Palestinian money, tax dollars, to the Palestinians because of the Hamas government. I personally think that's a mistake. I would have said, we're going to keep transferring the money, and as long as there's no violence on your part, as long as there's no suicide bombings, as long as we see you controlling the violence, we will continue transferring the money. The minute you violate that, then we're not going to transfer the money. But why not, Terry, why not just once? Let's try something new. Has the old way been working so well? Why not give them a reputation to live up to and make it entirely their responsibility because they are recidivists, because they couldn't change that they don't get the money? Why give them, as you rightly say, and this is what I wrote, why give them an excuse to blame us for their own failure? So, you know, I believe that we should let them either succeed on their own or fail on their own.
Are there ways that you think Hamas could move toward peace with Israel without recognizing Israel? Because they've never recognized Israel, and they might never recognize Israel. And if they do recognize it, it might take a long time. So in the meantime, is there anything that they might do to move toward peace?
Well, my own position is, why would you want Hamas's recognition today? I mean, if Hamas stood up tomorrow and sang Hatikva, the Israeli national anthem, in perfect Hebrew, is there any Israeli who would believe it? Would Israelis then suddenly say, oh, now you've recognized me? Oh, okay, here's the money, here's the tax dollars, here's the foreign aid. Why ask for something that even if they gave it to you, you wouldn't believe it anyways? Why not ask for something that is very concrete, not words, but deeds? Make it very clear. We expect a full and complete ceasefire to apply. You abide by the ceasefire, we will then extend cooperation with you. You don't, we will lift that cooperation. But I would judge them myself on their deeds, not their words. And maybe after a year of different deeds, then some different words by them might carry some meaning. Then I might want to invest in those different words.
Have you met any of the current leaders of Hamas?
When I was in Ramallah, I met some of the newly elected Hamas legislators, but none of them were from the top leadership.
Your impressions of the people you did meet?
They're an interesting crowd. A lot of them are quite well-read. A lot of them speak Hebrew because they learned Hebrew in Israeli prisons, and they had a lot of time to read and get degrees, either formal or informal, while they were in Israeli prisons. And so as a group, they're probably, you know, more articulate and educated than your average, you know, Palestinian. But I have no illusions about who these people are. These are people who embraced as a tactic, basically recruiting the flower of Palestinian youth and getting them to blow themselves up in Israeli buses and pizza parlors. So I have no illusions who they are. I have no illusions what their ultimate aspirations are. To me, the only question is, can you construct an environment where it's in their interest to maintain the ceasefire and it's in Israel's interest to maintain the ceasefire so these two societies can basically live apart? And I think that's still an open question. But for me, that's the only question.
On a level of optimism from 1 to 10 right now about the Middle East, where do you stand?
Do I get to go below zero?
Oh, I hope not.
It's really hard, Terry, to look out there and say, you know, if you just go out there, boy, you'd really see the positive trends, you know. There are a few pockets here or there, but the trend lines are not real positive anywhere you look around that neighborhood right now.
My guest is Tom Friedman. He writes a foreign affairs column for the New York Times. His bestseller about globalization, The World is Flat, is about to be published in a new, updated, and expanded edition. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times foreign affairs columnist Tom Friedman, and his book, The World is Flat, which is his bestseller about globalization, has just come out in a new expanded hardcover edition. You recently wrote about the National Security Strategy Doctrine that was released earlier this month, and it identifies Iran as the single country that poses the greatest danger to the U.S. today. You say the most frightening, scary, terrifying thing we could do to Iran today, short of an outright attack, is to get out of Iraq. What do you mean?
What I mean is that Iran benefits by our presence in Iraq in two very, very important ways, Terry. One is that our presence there deflects and absorbs the natural antipathy between Iraqi Arabs and Iranian Persians. And even though many Iraqis and Iranians are Shiites, nevertheless, this nationalist cultural divide, one speaking Arabic, the other speaking Persian, has been very pronounced. So by our presence in Iraq right now, we've basically become, you know, the enemy of everyone's enemy, and everyone is focused right now on us and what we do. If we were to leave Iraq, I believe a lot of the natural antipathy that has several thousand years of Mesopotamian history behind it would come to the fore between Iranian Persians and Iraqi Arabs, because the Iraqi Shiites, as much as a lot of them have cultural ties and religious ties to Iran, now see their chance to take power in Iraq for the first time in their history. And I don't think they want to take power in Iraq just to turn it over to Iran and become Iran's cat's paw in Iraq. So there is a natural rivalry there. I mean, all you have to do, Terry, is call an Iranian, an Arab, and see how quickly they correct you that we are not Arabs, we are Persians, thank you very much, to understand this cultural antipathy. So on the one hand, we absorb that, we the United States Army, by our presence, and we are basically preventing that antipathy from coming to the surface. I think if we were gone, Iran would have an enormously complicated management problem in dealing with Iraq, and you would very, very quickly see anti-Iranian Iraqi militias and political forces and political actors emerging. The second reason that our leaving Iraq would be a problem for Iran is that by our presence in Iraq, we basically give Iran a very local, nearby target that Iran can retaliate against in the event of an American attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. If we were not in Iraq, yes, there would be an American troop presence in Afghanistan, but it's widely dispersed. There would be no large-scale nearby American troop concentrations for Iraq to naturally retaliate against.
Now, do you consider this a serious argument for getting out of Iraq now?
No, I was simply making the argument in response to a kind of subterranean argument I hear very often, which is that, boy, are we stupid. We invaded Iraq and Iran won the war. Well, yes, maybe, as long as we stay there and we fail. See, Terry, from an American point of view, if we get out of Iraq, that's a huge problem for Iran. If we succeed in Iraq, if we manage to, in collaboration with Iraqis, produce a decent Iraqi government led by Shiites with real free and fair elections, with a real free press, that's also a huge problem for Iran, because Iran's population then will look at Iraq and say, wait a minute, why do they have free and fair elections and a free press? And we have elections that are circumscribed so that only people approved by the Ayatollahs can run. What's the deal? So that would also be a huge problem for Iran. What is not a problem for Iran, what is the ideal situation for Iran, is that we stay in Iraq, not midwifing a democracy, but babysitting a civil war and bleeding at the same time and being a convenient retaliatory target for Iran. So my argument is, if we get out of Iraq, that's going to be a huge problem for Iran. If we succeed in Iraq, that is going to be a huge problem for Iran, something I would much prefer. But what we must not do, what we must not do, is get caught up babysitting a civil war in Iraq. That would be the ideal scenario for Iran. Then Iran would win.
Is that the scenario we're in fact in right now, babysitting a civil war?
I believe we're very close to it. I believe the situation in Iraq is dire, and I believe that we are in a real crisis moment. And the reason I believe that is that what you've seen in the last couple of months, but particularly since the bombing of the Golden Dome Mosque in Samarra, is this kind of interpersonal, intersectarian violence on a very micro scale, where neighborhoods are clashing with neighborhoods, neighbors with neighbors, and you're seeing Iraqi Shiites and Iraqi Sunnis basically going out and beheading each other and then taking revenge for that beheading and beheading more people. One thing I learned in Lebanon, Terry, covering that civil war back in the late 1970s, is once this kind of very micro-tribal war starts, it is very, very hard to stop. It took Lebanon over a decade to do it. And even then, it required, you know, the Syrian army, a peace conference in Saudi Arabia, and even today, the smoldering embers of that period of tribal conflict still bedevils the Lebanese government. We are on the point in Iraq where this intersectarian violence, which wasn't there anywhere near the degree it is today, 2 years ago, is about to explode. And if it does, it's game over, because it'll be very, very difficult to build any kind of stable national unity government on top of that kind of boiling pot.
Tom Friedman writes a foreign affairs column for the New York Times. His bestseller about globalization, The World is Flat, is about to be published in a new, updated, and expanded edition. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Audible.com. Pray you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD available at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from Capella University, an accredited university committed to delivering academic excellence online at capella.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Tom Friedman tells us why he thinks Vice President Cheney is a wimp when it comes to our energy policy. And Lloyd Schwartz remembers Sarah Caldwell. She founded the Opera Company of Boston. She died last week at the age of 82. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with three-time Pulitzer Prize winner Tom Friedman. He writes a foreign affairs column for the New York Times. His latest book about globalization, The World is Flat, has been on the bestseller list for about a year. A new updated and expanded edition will be published next month. When we left off, we were talking about Iraq, which he thinks is on the verge of civil war. So if we're in civil war or heading towards civil war, what possible role can the U.S. play?
Well, let's back up for a second and first ask, why are we in this situation? And then what might we do? We're in this situation for two reasons. One, because President Bush chose to invade Iraq with the Rumsfeld Doctrine, Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense. The Rumsfeld Doctrine is, in my view, just enough troops to lose, as opposed to the Powell Doctrine of overwhelming force. So because Bush sided with Rumsfeld and we never had enough troops on the ground, we have never, to this day, established an occupation of Iraq. We've actually never established a monopoly of force in Iraq. I remember the Republican convention and Zell Miller from Georgia was going on and on against John Kerry and the Democrats, saying, how dare you people say we've occupied Iraq, you know, and that it's an American occupation of Iraq. And all I could think was, yo, Zell, I only wish it were an occupation. I only wish we had a monopoly of force. You know, what are you talking about? So because we have never established a monopoly of force, we had a security vacuum. In that security vacuum, a whole host of groups mushroomed up, some of them former Ba'athist elements of Saddam's regime, but also some really dark groups like Zarqawis, groups that I would call not Islamofascist. That's actually too nice. That connotes a certain political agenda. These are what I would call Islamo-nihilists. And the objective of these groups, Terry, is one very simple thing. America and its Iraqi allies must fail. And we will use any violence against any group of Muslims, any group of Iraqis, any mosque, any shrine. We will do whatever we must to ensure that America fails. By the way, these are people who are undeterrable because many of them want to kill themselves before you even get to them. Well, when you have that kind of nihilistic violence for week after week, month after month, directed primarily by Sunnis, again, these are mostly Sunni groups against the Shia, sooner or later, the Shia of Iraq, who are the majority, were going to say, you know what, we're not going to take it anymore. And therefore, Terry, if we do not immediately deploy massive numbers of Iraqi troops, police, and U.S. forces on the ground in Baghdad on every corner to bring this thing to a stop right now, this poison, and at the same time, if we don't get Iraqis to produce a national unity government at the top of Shiites, Kurds, and Sunnis willing to work together, then this poison is basically going to spread, and then will be babysitting a civil war. And then I believe whatever Bush says or wants, the American people are going to say, we're pulling the plug, warm up the bus.
Well, some people say we're already in civil war, including the former prime minister of Iraq. So if we're in it or on the verge of it, you use the word babysitting. We don't want to babysit a civil war. Well, if we don't want to babysit it, do we have any other options? What can we do if there's civil war?
Well, I said, I don't think we're in a full scale. All I know is where we are right now. And where we are right now is the emergence of widespread intertribal and intersectarian violence, largely in the Baghdad area where the communities are most mixed. If we don't bring that to a halt right now, then I believe any hope of a decent political outcome in Iraq will be certainly eliminated, if not postponed, for a long time. And therefore, I think the American public will pull the plug on this operation. I believe that the United States will withdraw from Iraq, or certainly redeploy at least to the Kurdish areas, to some safe area, and let people fight it out.
You've said that.
I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying that's where I think this is going
to
go.
Right. Now, you've said that, like, right now there needs to be
Iraqi
forces and American forces on every corner
second.
In Iraq. Right.
What George Bush is doing or thinking right now. And by the way, Tara, can I ask you a question? Let's turn the microphones around.
Uh-oh.
Who is in charge of overall American policy in Iraq? Who sets the day-to-day? Who is it in the U.S. government who thinks only 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, about Iraq and what to do there?
Well, it's supposed to be Donald Rumsfeld, isn't it?
Is it? I don't know. Is it him? Is it Condi Rice? Is it Steve Hadley? Is it Bush? Is it Megan O'Sullivan at the National Security Council? I have no idea. I have no idea who the we are. Who are we? Who's running this thing? And by the way, who is running it over there? Who is the they? I don't know who they are either. All I know is who them are, the bad guys, the nihilists. And right now, it's not even clear to me who's running the show over here. There is only one story. There's only one legacy. If George Bush thinks he's going to get up and walk away from this and going to that history is going to reward him for no child left behind, then he must be really nuts, okay? This is the ball game for this administration, and it's in the ninth inning right now. And if they don't understand that, they and we are going to pay an enormous price.
President Bush sent a message to the Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari that Bush doesn't want al-Jafari to remain the prime minister in the next government. Is that an appropriate kind of message for the president to be sending?
Well, you know, I'm of two minds of that, and I don't know exactly what message the president sent, but you know, we have equity there. You know, over 2,000 Americans have died there. Thousands more have been wounded. We've spent billions of dollars. And we do have a right to say that if this guy is completely inept at running the Iraqi government, as proven by the last 2 years, and if he's only in place there because a militia-leading thug named Muqtada Sadr wants him to be there, then excuse me, we're going to let you know that.
Let me ask you a question I've heard asked a lot by a lot of skeptics. And the question is, in order to have some kind of stability, some kind of peace in Iraq, do you need a strong man, not unlike Saddam Hussein, who can run the country with an iron hand? Would anything short of that lead to constant fighting or civil war?
Well, you know, something you and I have talked about going back a couple of years, Terry, is a question that I posed before we went into Iraq. And it went like this. Is Iraq the way Iraq is because Saddam was the way Saddam was? Or was Saddam the way Saddam was because Iraqis are the way Iraqis are? And we're going to get the answer to that question, basically. You know, is this a country that can only be ruled by a iron-fisted dictator? Or is it a country so tribalized now and so brutalized because it's been ruled by an iron-fisted dictator? Basically, Terry, we're involved right now in incredibly, I would say, noble, quixotic experiment in Iraq. And there's no other way to describe it but that. And this is in no way to diminish the incredible sacrifice of all the young men and women in the U.S. military who have been over there to call it an experiment. But it was an experiment. It was a test. It was a test that I think had enormous moral and strategic weight behind it. But the test was basically this. If you look at the Arab world today, if you look at all these Arab countries, they're all basically civil wars waiting to happen, okay? Because all these countries were for the most part, the creation of imperial powers who imposed the borders on these people and entrapped, you know, various communities inside these borders. And these countries have historically been ruled either by colonial powers from the top down or by kings and dictators from the top down. What we are doing in Iraq today is an unprecedented experiment. We are hosting the first ever horizontal dialogue in the history of the Arab Muslim world. Terry, I do not know whether the horizontal dialogue between these communities will be able to produce a social contract between them by which the people will be able to govern themselves without an iron fist. I do not know the answer to that question. All I do know is if they fail in Iraq, no one else in the Arab world is going to try for a long, long time. So if Iraq fails, you can look forward to a future of Bashar Assad's, Hosni Mubarak's, and Muammar Gaddafi's as far as the eye can see. And thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It was precisely that kind of top-down dictatorial government, I believe, that has produced the pathologies that gave you 9/11.
My guest is Tom Friedman. He writes a foreign affairs column for the New York Times and is the author of the bestseller, The World is Flat. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times foreign affairs columnist Tom Friedman, and his latest book is the bestseller about globalization, The World is Flat, and now it's just been published in a new and expanded hardcover edition. You know, throughout the riots against the Danish Muhammad cartoons, I thought about you. Because you've written so extensively about globalization and what that means. And this is this was an example of cultural globalization kind of blowing up in the face of the West. You basically had people, you know, in Denmark publishing these cartoons and then having to go into hiding because of death threats. And then, you have riots all over the Muslim world in reaction to those cartoons. And of course, it leads a lot of people to wonder, does globalization also mean that people in other countries will be setting the editorial agenda through threats for the West?
I don't think so. But there is a real flat world dimension to this Danish story. And the way I see it, Terry, is that through a couple of angles. The first is, when the world is flat, you get your humiliation fiber optically, okay? You get it at 100 megabytes per second because you can see just where the caravan is and just how far behind you are. Now, you talk to young Arabs and Muslims in Pakistan and Afghanistan, especially those who are protesting the Danish cartoons. What's the word you hear? What's the word you see most often, always, somewhere in their quotations? It's the word humiliation. This is a deeply humiliated group of people. Because in the flat world, they can see just how far ahead other communities are and just how far behind they are. And at the same time, though, they have been taught from youth that their faith is the most perfect expression of the monotheistic creed. Well, how can that be? If we have God 3.0, the most perfect monotheistic operating system, and the Christians have God 2.0, and the Jews have God 1.0, and the Hindus have God 0.0, how can it be that they're doing better than we are? And that is a source of enormous humiliation. And what happens with humiliated people, Terry, is their skin gets really thin. And when your skin is really thin, the smallest slight, even from 1,000 miles away in a Danish cartoon, can cut to the very core of your being. And I think that's what this whole Danish cartoon thing was about. Does globalization allow them to intimidate the West? I'm not sure it's globalization. It certainly allows them to issue threats that are heard more quickly and more at a greater distance. But I would be careful about that. You see, I think you can push democracies so far. But, you know, as Hitler learned, democracies are slow to action. But when they really get angry and when they really see themselves threatened, they will defend themselves.
It seems from reading your columns that you've been particularly down on Vice President Cheney lately, in part because of America's oil policy or lack of oil policy. And one of the things you've written, you said Cheney and big oil have defined realism when it comes to U.S. energy policy, and therefore they have owned the debate. How do you think that, as you put it, Cheney and big oil have defined what realism is in the energy debate?
Well, you know, to name something is to own it. And they've defined realism in the energy debate the following way. And you really hear this if you go to oil conferences. Oh, Tom, you know, those alternative energies, ethanol and solar and wind, even nuclear. I mean, they're nice and they're cute and they're virtuous and all. And I know you and your green tree-hugging pals, you know, love to talk about that around the solar fire. But real men understand that we're going to need oil and we're going to be dependent on oil for as far as the eye can see. So get used to it, little man. And my answer back, Terry, is basically that you, Mr. Cheney, and all your pals are basically the biggest wimps in America today. Because what you don't understand, my friend, is that this is not your grandfather's energy crisis for four reasons. Number one, we're in a war on terrorism with people who are fueled and funded by our energy purchases. We are funding both sides in the war on terrorism, the U.S. Army, Navy, and Air Force with our tax dollars, Al-Qaeda and its supportive, you know, groups through various Islamic charities that are indirectly funded by our energy purchases, number one. Number two, the world is flat, and 3 billion new players just walked onto the playing field with their own version of the American dream, a house, a car, a toaster, and a microwave. If we don't find an alternative way to provide energy for these 3 billion new players, not to mention the others that are already on that flat world playing field, we're going to burn up, choke up, heat up, and smoke up this planet faster than any time in the history of the world. And one need only see what's going on with the glaciers in Antarctica and in the Arctic Circle right now to see the effects of this. Number three, because of number two, green technology is going to be the industry of the 21st century. Green design, green building, green manufacturing, green consulting. Now, there's one way and one way only to get a leap in this technology, and that is by imposing the highest standards and demanding the highest performance from our own cars, our own buildings, and our own appliances. So what are Cheney and Big Oil doing? No, they tell Detroit, no, guy, we don't want you to improve your mileage standards. We wouldn't want to impose anything harsh on you. Well, thank you very much, Terry. That's why today Harley-Davidson, a motorcycle company, is worth more than General Motors. And number four, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, we thought the fall of the Berlin Wall was going to unleash an unstoppable tide of free markets and free democracy. Well, what's happened instead as a result of $60 a barrel oil is that this unstoppable wave of freedom and democracy has met for the first time a counterwave of petro-authoritarianism. These are autocratic, authoritarian regimes, some of them elected, people like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Putin in Russia, Ahmadinejad in Iran, the people in Nigeria. And what you have today basically are a whole cluster of governments that now have more money than ever to do the worst things in the world. So excuse me, Mr. Cheney and Big Oil. I know you think that being environmentally sound, I know you think that conservation, I know you think that alternative energies are just for liberal, tree-hugging, environmental, vaguely French-speaking wusses and wimps like me. But I got news for you, pal, okay, that being green today is the most geostrategic, geoeconomic, capitalist, patriotic thing any American can do. Green is the new red, white, and blue.
So is it fair to say you've given up on the Bush administration when it comes to energy policy?
Pretty much. At this stage, I'm rooting for the Iranian government to do something really crazy. Then oil will go to $100 a barrel, and the sooner we get to $100 a barrel, Terry, the sooner we're going to be on wind and solar and ethanol, nuclear, we're going to be off oil. I say to Ahmadinejad in Iran, you go, girl, as crazy as you want. Get as crazy as you want, pal. I'm sorry we're going to have to make this transfer of wealth to you in the short run, that we're not going to tax oil in this country, so we'd get to capture it and use it for our schools, our social security, our infrastructure. But Bush and Cheney aren't going to do that. So I just got one word, you go, girl.
Tom Friedman, thanks so much for talking with us.
A pleasure.
Tom Friedman writes a foreign affairs column for the New York Times. His bestseller about globalization, The World is Flat, is about to be published in a new, updated, and expanded edition. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz remembers Sarah Caldwell, founder of the Opera Company of Boston. She died last week. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Sarah Caldwell, who died last Thursday at the age of 82, was considered to be one of the most innovative opera directors of her time. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is a longtime resident of Boston, where Caldwell founded her opera company. He's seen many of her productions and has this appreciation.
It's extraordinary to go to a theater and feel that what you're about to experience might be something you'll remember with pleasure the rest of your life. That's how I felt about Sarah Caldwell's productions for her Opera Company of Boston, the company she founded in 1958 and which closed shop in 1990. Not every production fulfilled that promise. Some of them could be pretty dismal, but all of them were ambitious and noble ventures. And some of them made such an impression on me, decades later, I can still relive them in my mind's eye. Take Schoenberg's Moses and Aaron, for example, which Caldwell presented in 1966, its American premiere years before the Metropolitan Opera got around to it. It's a challenging, difficult work. But when the curtain went up on Caldwell's production, we saw two figures standing back to back in a spotlight. This simple but profound image alerted us to what the opera was about, that Moses and Aaron were opposite sides of the same person, the tongue-tied visionary and the easy talker who could communicate his brother's vision. Sarah Caldwell herself was a visionary who could also communicate her vision of opera as total theater. It wasn't easy for her. For several years, she didn't even have a theater. But she could turn unpromising venues into theatrical gold. One of her best productions took place in a 19th-century brick building originally built to house a huge mural of the Battle of Gettysburg. It had a spectacular glass dome in the center. For her production of Gustave Charpentier's opera Louise, Caldwell transformed Boston's old cyclorama building into Montmartre, with jugglers, acrobats, and street vendors crowding the aisles. At the climax, a simple spotlight focused on a rotating mirror ball high up under the dome suddenly turned the whole theater into a gigantic, whirling carousel we were all riding. Caldwell worked with many major stars, but her reigning prima donna was Beverly Sills. One of Caldwell's American premieres was a dazzling production of an 18th-century opera by Rameau, Hippolyte et Aricie, in which Sills had to sing brilliant high notes, trills, and roulades. No one knew she could sing that kind of music, or that her co-star could, an unknown young Spanish tenor named Plácido Domingo. Sills later appeared at the New York City Opera as Cleopatra in Handel's Julius Caesar, singing a similar style of music. And that performance made her a superstar. But Caldwell was there first. Here's Sills as Juliet and the heartbreaking Tatiana Troianos as Romeo in Bellini's The Capulets and the Montagues, maybe the best of Sills' legendary series of bel canto performances. Caldwell also wanted to conduct. She became the first woman to conduct at the Met and the second to lead the New York Philharmonic. She made the cover of Time magazine. But conducting distracted her from what she did incomparably, total theater. Her greatest achievement was an adventurous repertory that mixed modern and unusual operas with the more familiar. She produced a dozen U.S. premieres, and such significant musical events as the first American performances of Mussorgsky's Boris Godunov in the composer's own orchestration, Verdi's Don Carlo in its original French version, and the original versions, very different from the ones we know, of such popular works as Puccini's Madame Butterfly and Gounod's Faust. Finally, to its shame, Boston couldn't support Caldwell's company. She had bought an old movie theater and turned it into an opera house, but it needed too many expensive repairs. She finally had to sell it, and her health problems were getting increasingly severe. Those of us who loved her work always kept hoping she'd make a comeback. The news of March 23rd dashed those hopes.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Four live productions by Sarah Caldwell's Opera Company of Boston are available on CD from the VAI label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Henry Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, available in stores and online. From GM, with 1.5 million flex-fuel vehicles on the road that run on gasoline or E85 ethanol. Details at livegreengoyellow.com. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, British actor Clive Owen. He co-stars in the new Spike Lee film, Inside Man. Join us for the next Fresh Air.